An American president momentously once urged intervention in a foreign country to protect the human rights of the people there. U.S. military might was required, in his words, in the cause of humanity and to put an end to the barbarities, bloodshed, starvation, and horrible miseries now existing there. It was 1898, and the president was William McKinley. The country he deemed to be in need of U.S. intervention was Cuba. The war that followed, the Spanish-American War, left the United States an imperial power, controlling Cuba, the Philippines, Guam, and Puerto Rico. Warren Zimmerman, who is a retired career diplomat, tells the story of America's rise to world power and five people who made it possible in his book, The First Great Triumph. Warren, welcome.
Thank you.
Were the violations of human rights by Imperial Spain a fig leaf for American ambitions or a source of real concern?
Well, they were a fig leaf for the people who wanted to go to war for strategic reasons, and that would include Theodore Roosevelt, Henry Cabot Lodge, who was the junior senator from Massachusetts, and Alfred Mahan, who was the great naval strategist. They wanted Cuba because it had strategic importance. But McKinley himself, who had fought in the Civil War and felt very sensitive toward people, really considered that human rights was the real reason to go in. And McKinley was a brilliant politician who was always testing the water among the American people. And he felt that because of all the publicity that had been given to the atrocities and alleged atrocities by Spain, that the people wanted war. So McKinley did too.
There's a critical moment, it seems, in turning the Senate's opinion in favor of war intervention in Cuba, at least, if not the dismantling the entire Spanish Empire, occasioned by a speech given by a Vermont senator.
Yes. But before that, Robert, I think I have to mention that the Maine, a battleship that had been sent down to Cuba to protect the American population there from Spanish hostility, was sunk on the 15th of February, 1898. It was almost certainly not sunk by the Spanish, but of course that was the spin that Roosevelt and the yellow press gave it. So there was already a tremendous degree of hostility towards Spain. Then along came that senator, Redfield Proctor, a very conservative Republican from Vermont, not one known to favor war at all, but he had been down to Cuba and he had investigated the so-called Spanish reconcentration policy, which was to put wives and children into areas so that they could then go out and kill their husbands who were part of the Cuban Revolutionary Force.
And this is the origin of the phrase, the concentration camp.
That really, yes, it is. That was the first one. In any case, Proctor was horrified by what he saw. He came back and gave a very short but very pointed speech in the Senate, and that tended to tip the business community in the United States toward war. They had been very hesitant. Proctor had been a businessman, and the other senators as well. It was an enormously influential speech.
You state in your purpose in writing this book that you're not out to write an ideological either denunciation or rationalization for American imperialism. I wonder, though, one ideological analysis of such things is that it's economically driven, that the Marxist interpretation would be imperialism is the natural outgrowth of capitalism. It doesn't seem to be the case the way you describe it.
I don't think so. The economic forces in the United States were split over whether we should invade Cuba and fight Spain. And many of them didn't want that to happen. And that's why Proctor's speech was so important, because he brought over a lot of these wavering business people. No, I don't think economics had too much to do with it. I think human rights was enormously important. This was the first war we ever fought for pure human rights. Mm-hmm. And in the background, among the war hawks like Roosevelt, was the strategic idea that we had to become dominant in the Caribbean, and Cuba was the key to that.
Of course, the irony here is that the war fought for the rights of the Cubans. Of course, it did spare the Cuban Spanish rule, but it led instantly to a long guerrilla war in the Philippines and to constant tension with the Cubans thereafter.
We were at our worst, I think, after the war in both Cuba and the Philippines. We cut the Cuban revolutionaries who had helped us win out of the peace agreement, and we ran Cuba as a military dictatorship for 4 years. In the Philippines, it was even worse because we got in a 3-year war against the Philippine revolutionaries who, again, had helped us defeat the Spanish. Those were the main black marks of what we did in that time.
How did people reconcile that? How did they reconcile this, as they saw it, this noble effort to assist the peoples of the Philippines and Cuba with being at odds with those very same people immediately thereafter?
Well, this was a period where Anglo-Saxonism was very important. It was a real racist doctrine, and every great university in the United States taught it. So the idea was these people were a little bit unfortunate, but they were in the way of progress. They were in the way of America's fulfilling its destiny as an imperial power. So they had to get out of the way. The Cubans had to get out of the way. The Filipinos had to get out of the way. There was a strong opposition to this among the anti-imperialists, particularly Mark Twain, who hated the idea that we were taking over the Philippines and denying the independence of the Philippines to the people who had been fighting for several years against the Spanish to have independence.
But that movement just didn't prevail, neither then nor in later years.
No, it didn't. It didn't. The wave of the future was surely going to be American imperialism and America growing to be a great power.
I'm just curious, after having immersed yourself in the careers of five people who were instrumental in this movement to make America an imperial power, which of them most improved in your esteem and which of them most declined after you got deeply involved in their lives?
I think Theodore Roosevelt declined for me. The one who improved in my esteem the most was Elihu Root. Elihu Root was the first administrator of American colonies ever. He was appointed by McKinley to be Secretary of War and to run Cuba, Puerto Rico, and the Philippines. He made huge mistakes, but he did produce a kind of a democratic system with democratic institutions, with health facilities, with good schools, and so forth. It was a kind of a model of how a good imperial government can work.
And Roosevelt, on the other hand, emerges from your account, certainly, as someone who, younger than, say, John Hay, was really untouched by the horror of the Civil War, was trying to make up for his father not having served in the Civil War, you would say, and had a pretty gung-ho attitude toward men going out, killing and dying on the battlefield.
The kinds of things Roosevelt said about war you could never say today. You would be laughed at. You would be ridiculed. I mean, he thought war in itself was good. He didn't care who we fought. Mm-hmm. It could be Germany. It could be Great Britain. It could be Spain. He just wanted to get us into war because it had ennobling qualities. Nobody says that anymore.
Warren Zimmerman, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're certainly welcome, Robert.
Warren Zimmerman is the author of The First Great Triumph, How Five Americans Made Their Country a World Power.